Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. A ceasefire in Trump's war. Then what? International efforts to reopen the Strait of Hormuz have so far failed. And the human costs of Trump's war. First, a ceasefire. Then what? Until Tuesday, Iran had rejected the idea of a ceasefire, arguing that it could only approve a permanent cessation of hostilities. As one knowledgeable observer said, any proposal put before Iran would have to include not only a halt to the current operation, but also a credible commitment that it will not be resumed, in effect, an end to the campaign. If the choice was between a temporary ceasefire and continued fighting, this observer went on to say, Iran would surely keep fighting, especially inasmuch as it believes it is winning. Yet now, a temporary ceasefire is in effect. Iran says it's a victory, since a permanent ceasefire is on the agenda and the Strait of Hormuz remains under its control. U.S. policy so far has been about bombing while making demands and threats. It has joined Israel in attacking bridges, rail lines, science institutes, and industrial plants on the probably specious argument that they all have or could have military use. The latest U.S. attacks have been on Karg Island, home to Iran's oil exports, and inched closer to a nuclear power plant, drawing condemnation from the World Health Organization. Most disturbingly, Trump has several times threatened attacks on Iran's energy infrastructure, which would surely be a war crime. His latest and most dire warning came following a profane and deranged threat the other day in which he said, quote, we're going to hit them extremely hard over the next 2 or 3 weeks. We're going to bring them back to the Stone Age where they belong. When another deadline passed for Iran to reopen the strait, he proclaimed Monday that, quote, a whole civilization will die tonight and that, quote, the entire country can be taken out in one night and that night might be tomorrow night. That language drew condemnations from Pope Leo and the head of human rights at the United Nations. Some far-right commentators, not to mention many congressional Democrats, are calling for invoking the 25th Amendment to remove Trump. Some reports had Iran pulling out of the indirect talks that Pakistan was brokering. But Tuesday, Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif appealed to Trump to delay further attacks on Iran for 2 weeks, while talks, which he characterized as showing progress, proceeded. Sharif proposed a temporary ceasefire and Iran's opening of the Strait of Hormuz during those 2 weeks. That proposal was just what Trump needed to back away from his latest threat. The taco label is alive and well. A 2-week ceasefire prevails, and Iran has agreed to reopen the strait, which Trump said was a condition for agreeing to the ceasefire. Now Trump is saying that Iran's 10-point peace plan is, quote, a workable basis on which to negotiate. But that plan includes an end to U.S. sanctions, Iranian control of the Strait of Hormuz, uranium enrichment for Iran, and a permanent ceasefire, all contrary to U.S. proposals. Going forward, the fundamental problem of incredibly incompetent U.S. policy planning remains. As New York Times interviews reveal, Trump's hubris, his alignment with Netanyahu, and the obsequiousness of Trump's inner circle, all of whom are ignorant about Iran and unwilling to oppose Trump's instincts, account for the fateful miscalculations and misperceptions that have driven the U.S. into war. Trump's and Marco Rubio's firing of numerous intelligence professionals in the State Department, CIA, and other agencies ensured that expertise would not be brought to bear on decision-making. Consequently, the U.S. has had to rely on more and more bombing that, first, will not eliminate Iran's leadership, second, will not bring on a popular uprising, third, will not force Iran to negotiate on U.S. terms, fourth, will not reopen the Strait of Hormuz, and fifth, will not defeat Iran's asymmetric strategy of retaliation. The chief question, then, is what leverage the U.S. has in talks with Iran about extending a truce, and how well it can control Israel, the wild card, whose ongoing bombing of Iran has already caused it to close the strait. International efforts to reopen the Strait of Hormuz have so far failed. One plan was introduced at the UN by Bahrain, a resolution that authorized all defensive means necessary to protect shipping through the strait for 6 months. The resolution required 9 votes and no veto from the permanent 5 powers on the Security Council in order to pass. A Chinese or Russian veto meant the resolution's failure, and both those countries used it. China's argument was that, quote, defensive means risks legitimizing the unlawful and indiscriminate use of force, which would inevitably lead to further escalation. Another peace attempt prior to the U.S.-Iran agreement Tuesday was by about 40 countries that discussed joint action to reopen the Strait of Hormuz and stop Iran from holding the global economy hostage, as Britain's Foreign Minister Yvette Cooper put it. Iran's recklessness in blockading the waterway was hitting households and businesses in every corner of the world, she added. The meeting included France, Germany, Canada, the United Arab Emirates, and India. According to the Associated Press, quote, there have been 23 direct attacks on commercial vessels in the Gulf since the war began on February 28, and 11 crew members have been killed, according to shipping data from Lloyd's List Intelligence. Traffic through the strait has slowed to a trickle, with what remains dominated by sanctions-evading tankers carrying Iranian oil. So far, however, no plan for permanently reopening the strait has generated great interest, especially if by force. The risks of failure are high. Other than France, no country wants to meet Trump's insistence on having warships accompany oil and other commercial ships. Some countries want any plan to be approved by the UN. China and Pakistan offered a 5-point plan that is long on rhetoric but short on action. Europe and the rest of the world are probably stuck until a ceasefire takes hold for more than a few weeks, and that is far from assured. Next, the human costs of Trump's war. 1 month of the American-Israeli war with Iran could plunge 4 million more people across the Arab world into poverty and shave off up to 6% of the region's economic output during that time, according to projections by the United Nations Development Program. Its report, released last week, uses an economic simulation to project the effects of an ongoing conflict and warns of, quote, profound and widespread socioeconomic impacts across the Arab region. Casualty figures are mounting. In all, at least 5,000 people, military and civilian, have been killed in this war. Various international agencies say that in Iran, at least 1,900 people have been killed, including around 250 children, by U.S.-Israeli strikes so far. 12 top Iranian officials have been assassinated. Anywhere from 1,500 to 3,000 Iranian and Hezbollah soldiers have been killed. More than 1,500 people have now been killed in Lebanon, and 3,750 wounded. At least 125 children and 52 healthcare workers are among the dead, according to Lebanon's health ministry. 9 Lebanese soldiers have been killed, and 3 United Nations peacekeepers from Indonesia were killed in 2 separate incidents in southern Lebanon. Other casualties include 19 civilians and 6 soldiers killed in Israel, 100 in Iraq, 10 in the United Arab Emirates, 7 in Qatar, 7 in Kuwait, 2 in Bahrain, 4 in Syria, and 2 in Saudi Arabia. Not enough has been said about Lebanon as a front in this war. An April 2nd report from Reuters confirms what I and others have said about Israel's operations in Lebanon. It's all about expanding territory in the name of national security. The Reuters report says that, quote, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said he had ordered the military to further expand its operations in southern Lebanon, citing continued rocket fire by Hezbollah. Israel said last week it was enlarging a buffer zone up to the Litani River. I have now instructed to further expand the existing security zone in order to finally thwart the threat of invasion and to push the anti-tank missile fire away from our border, Netanyahu said. That security zone means a prolonged occupation and perhaps one that will become permanent. Here at home, President Trump has made clear that the war's costs will come at society's expense. In his last nationwide address, in which he suggested the war will last another 3 weeks, he lost an opportunity to refocus his work on what most upsets Americans, the cost of living. Instead, he gave passing mention to the possibility of negotiations with Iran and made the outlandish claim that the war is, quote, a true investment in your children and your grandchildren's future. Fighting wars, Trump is now saying, means no money is available for daycare and no possibility of federal funding of Medicare and Medicaid either. States, he said, should take care of these expenses, quote, because the U.S. can't. We have 50 states. We have all these other people. We're fighting wars. We can't take care of daycare. We have to take care of one thing, military protection, we have to guard the country, unquote. The setting for this rant was an Easter luncheon. In other news, the European Union will send 1.4 billion euros in Russian assets to Ukraine. The EU announced at the end of March that it will deliver 1.4 billion euros in windfall profits generated by the interest on the cash balances originating from immobilized assets of the Russian Central Bank. The principal remains with Russia for now, but the accruing interest is going to Ukraine. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said, quote, "These 1.4 billion euros will be directed where they are needed most, to sustain the Ukrainian state, preserve essential public services, and support the brave Ukrainian armed forces. Our commitment to Ukraine's victory and freedom is unwavering." Iran's president writes to the American people. Prior to the ceasefire agreement, President Pezeshkian addressed Americans with a history lesson about U.S. interference in Iran since the 1950s, U.S. threats to Iran's civilian infrastructure, the role of the U.S. military-industrial complex, and Israel's influence over U.S. policy. His open letter naturally avoided any discussion of the Iran regime's crackdowns on citizens or its support of Hezbollah and the Houthis in Yemen. Still, much of what he had to say is factual and in keeping with what our own critics of the war are saying. With respect, for instance, to Trump's threats, some already realized, to target Iran's energy and industrial facilities, President Pezeshkian said these, quote, "target the Iranian people. Beyond constituting a war crime, such actions carry consequences that extend far beyond Iran's borders. They generate instability, increase human and economic costs, and perpetuate cycles of tension, planting seeds of resentment that will endure for years," unquote. Pezeshkian called for peace, but did not offer any proposal for reaching it. However, he did ask the right question, quote, "exactly which of the American people's interests are truly being served by this war?" Almost needless to say, Pezeshkian's open letter was hardly noticed in the American press. Hungary's election pits the United States against Europe. Trump has sent Marco Rubio and now J.D. Vance to Hungary to bolster the presidential campaign of Viktor Orban, who has been in power for 16 years. The election, April 12, promises to be close despite Orban's autocratic rule. Most polls show Orban losing. Vance gave a talk in which he sharply criticized the European Union for interfering in Hungary's election. Without missing a beat, he followed up that claim by endorsing Orban, as though that wasn't interference. Now Polish and Irish leaders have cited a leaked audio that appears to capture Hungary's foreign minister telling Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov that he will try to amend the EU's sanctions list to accommodate Russia. The leaders called the finding repulsive and sinister. The leak was published by four different European media outlets. Poland's Prime Minister Donald Tusk said the audio showed the deeply disturbing relationship between Hungary and Russia, quote, "the political dependency of the Budapest government on Moscow." In response, Hungary's foreign minister did not deny the call, but blamed foreign secret services for wiretapping. Finally, updates from two countries whose leaders say they don't need democracy. Myanmar will continue to be ruled by a military-backed autocrat, Senior General Min Aung Hlaing. Though a military website described his election as a return to civilian-led democracy, the general was elected by the military-dominated parliament and was involved in all the events subsequent to the 2021 coup that have suppressed democracy. As Bertha Lindner, an expert on Myanmar, writes, quote, "all major pro-democracy parties were dissolved well before the recent election, which led to the preordained landslide victory for the military's political wing, the Union Solidarity and Development Party." And in Burkina Faso, the young coup leader in that Central African nation is providing a textbook lesson on how the military seizes and holds on to political power. Captain Ibrahim Traoré, who seized power 3 years ago, had pledged in 2024 to restore democracy, but then decided to hold on to power for another 5 years. Now he says politicians and parties are all corrupt and are best cast aside. People, he says, need to forget about the issue of democracy. It's not for us. and he cited the Libyan example of autocratic rule coupled with social gains. Captain Traore says military rule will mean economic and military self-reliance and an emphasis on patriotism and revolutionary mobilization. So far, that has meant a crackdown on his critics. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.